This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth, and certainly important to all people. There is no greater threat than Jewish supremacism on this planet to peace, to security, to heritage, and to the freedom of all people. And we're seeing a living example of this threat in what's happening in Lebanon. The carnage, the terrorism, the murder, the occupation, the ethnic cleansing that Israel is conducting right now against the Lebanese people is something which will not only harm, obviously, the people that they are attacking and killing and murdering, but it will also harm deeply the people of the United States of America, because our policy has been hijacked by Israel and supports this murderous criminal policy of Israel. Israel's in violation of the United Nations resolution for them to leave the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza. Israel's truly in violation of the United Nations resolutions for Israel to leave Lebanon, because now they're back into Lebanon. Israel is violating the Geneva Convention. Israel is violating the rules of warfare, and Israel is conducting great terrorism. I have been doing an audio version of my book, Jewish Supremacism, and now I'm on Chapter 8, The Origins of Antisemitism, Crime, and Treachery. And yesterday I left off talking about slavery. What a fascinating part of that chapter the slavery section is. It's just an amazing scenario when you find out that Jews have led the slave trade for 2,000 years. And that's quite different than what's portrayed by the chroniclers of, quote, anti-Semitism, those Jewish extremists, Jewish supremacist chroniclers who always blame opposition to Jews on some sort of defect within Gentiles themselves and never talk about Jewish crimes and Jewish activities of a nature which cause a very strong reaction from Gentiles, whether they be European or Arabian or anywhere, any other people around the world. And by the way, it is kind of interesting how anti-Semitism tends to grow up all over the world, whether you're talking about Mexico or South America or the Caribbean or North America or Europe or any nation of Europe or even the Middle East, the Far East, parts of Africa, parts of Asia. It exists. And maybe it exists for some fundamental reasons that are not talked about. So today we're going to go into white slavery, and I think this part of the chapter will shock you very deeply, because white slavery is, to me, one of the most pernicious activities in existence in the world. I mean, the degradation of little boys, European women and girls, and this kind of sexual degradation and slavery is perhaps one of the worst crimes of humanity. And now it's flourishing more powerfully and more prominently than ever. And again, it is completely led, dominated by the Jewish white slave traders. And I will show you that in this next audio part of the chapter, The Origins of Antisemitism, Crime, and Treachery, in Part 3. So here we go. The Origins of Antisemitism, Crime, and Treachery, Part 3. The next section is called White Slavery. Prostitution, or white slavery, as it's aptly called, is another institution as old as civilization. Even in ancient times, the fair skin and beauty of European women and little boys and girls brought a premium from the purveyors of perhaps the most brutal kind of slavery of all, the sexual defilement of one's body. The subjection of countless innocents to the filth and pain of sexual degradation is a crime of enormous magnitude. Just as they dominated the organized slave trade, Jews dominated prostitution. It originally came about as a natural adjunct to slavery, as it took no special commercial acumen to realize that a female or young boy slave could be rented out for sexual abuse, and fair European maidens could fetch great prices from the sultans of the darker nations. From the days of the concubines of King David to the modern madams, Xavier Hollander and Heidi Fleiss, Jews have dominated the sex business. The Talmud itself is obsessed with sexual connections and what it calls natural and unnatural kinds of sexual connections, of sexual relations with adults, with little boys and girls, with bondmaidens and with harlots. In the modern age, Freud and his colleagues in academia brought this perverted view of our natures into the classrooms and living rooms of America. Freud, with the help of his Jewish-influenced media, told Western society with a straight face that sexual and excretory organs are the most important factors in life and that every male secretly desires to have sexual relations with his mother. In looking into the history of prostitution, I read about a maleficent deception Jews used in Central Europe during the last century. During times of famine or economic hardship, well-dressed, fast-talking Jews would go into peasant communities and tell the parents of attractive Christian teenagers that their children could have a better life in America, an America which had a shortage of household labor. The Jews told the parents that after a short time, their children could pay off the cost of their passage and begin a new life in the land of freedom and plenty. In spite of the pain of being separated from their children, some of the parents would consent to such an arrangement, wanting the best for their daughters. But instead of finding a bright new life, tens of thousands ended up suffering in the brothels of the New World. In his book, Prostitution and Prejudice, Jewish historian Edward Bristow writes about the World Prostitution Network and clearly shows the prominent Jewish role. It's not hard to conceive of the reaction of many Eastern Europeans to the Jewish enslavement and degradation of tens of thousands of Christian girls. Bristow reveals that the center of the Jewish trade in Gentile women from Poland and surrounding regions was a small town called Oswiecim, which the Germans called Auschwitz. That simple revelation can bring much understanding of the recurrent Jewish and Gentile conflict. Jewish domination of white slavery continues. In fact, it is on a larger scale now than ever before in history. The New Orleans Times-Picayune on January 11, 1998, ran an article titled, quote, "Slave Traders Lure Slavic Women." It, written by Michael Spector and distributed by the Jewish-run New York Times News Service, documents a Jewish-run white slave operation of huge proportions. The piece begins with a poignant story of how a beautiful blonde Ukrainian girl, hoping to escape poverty and despair of her village life, answered an ad in a small newspaper in her hometown promising work and opportunity abroad. She wound up as a sex slave in Israel. And here's a quotation. She was 21, self-assured, and glad to be out of Ukraine. Israel offered a new world, and for a week or two, everything seemed possible. Then one morning, she was driven to a brothel where her boss burned her passport before her eyes. "I own you," she recalled his saying. "You are my property, and you will work until you earn your way out. Don't try to leave. You have no papers, and you don't speak Hebrew. You'll be arrested and deported. Then we will get you and bring you back." Unquote. In Israel, the government does little to end the brutal slave system other than deport a small percentage of the girls they find with no immigration papers. Almost 1,500 Ukrainian women have been deported from Israel in the past 3 years. The deck is completely stacked against the Gentile women and in favor of the slave masters. For if they file a complaint against the slave master, they must remain in prison until a trial is held. Spector quotes the prison director at Nev-Tirsta as saying she did not know of a single girl who chose to testify against her Jewish slave masters. The white slaver is thus protected by the Israeli system, while the victims are punished. Spector identifies both the prostitutes and their masters. He quotes an Israeli white slave master, Jacob Golan, and I quote, "The women who work there, like nearly all prostitutes in Israel, are Russian. Their boss is not. Israelis love Russian girls," said Jacob Golan. "They are blonde and good-looking and different from us," he said, chuckling. Unquote. Of course, Israel is not the only destination of the Eastern European women. The Jewish gangs in Russia have strong connections with Jewish organized crime syndicates all over the world. According to the Ukraine's Interior Ministry, an estimated 400,000 women under the age of 30 were lured from the Ukraine in the past decade. And this is just one of the former Soviet states. Spector quotes the International Organization for Migration as estimating that 500,000 Eastern Bloc women are trafficked into Western Europe and around the world annually. It's a tragedy of huge proportions that gets very little press. Moment Magazine, the magazine of Jewish culture and opinion, had an article on page 44, the April 1998 edition, called "Hookers in the Holy Land." In it, they discuss the thriving prostitution of blonde Russian girls as a, quote, national institution. It goes on to talk about the customers, who even include rabbis, riding bicycles to the whorehouses. Quote, "A good percentage of the customers, or Johns in the lingo, are ultra-Orthodox Jews, pious men whose lives are guided by halakha, religious law, which tells them when they can or cannot have sex with their wives. So on Thursday afternoons, boys' night out in Israel, busloads of Orthodox Jews travel from Jerusalem, Haifa, and points beyond to Tel Aviv for a few precious moments of passion in a massage parlor, behind a sand dune, or in an alleyway. Other customers are accountants, lawyers, policemen, and politicians. The entire spectrum of Israeli society is keeping the hookers in business," claims Detective Shakar, a cynical veteran on the Tel Aviv Vice detail. Tel Baruch is so very absurd and so very Israel. It blatantly goes on to describe the girls, who are mostly Eastern European Gentile women, along with some Palestinians, as virtual slaves who were put on a slave auction block. Quote, "Once the girls arrive in Israel, the crime bosses take over. The girls are usually taken to an auction house where the owners of the various massage parlors can bid on the talent. Each one offers a price, and the highest bidder gets the girl. The girls are virtual slaves." Unquote. The article goes on to note that many of the prostitutes in Israel, especially those of Arab descent, encounter physical abuse from Jews who abuse them as an expression of their racial nationalist fervor, unquote. Quote, "find that their Jewish customers only come to them after a Palestinian terrorist act to get their own brand of sexual revenge laced with racial nationalistic fervor, and they do it with hate and anger," unquote. In discussing the forged documents used to smuggle girls into Israel, Spector notes that they have often been obtained from elderly Jewish women in the Ukraine. Even so, Spector casually refers to the Jewish perpetrators of this international white slavery ring as, quote, "Russian crime gangs" or, quote, "Russian mafia." It would be bad for Jewish public relations if the Times-Picayune had titled the article, "Jewish Slave Traders Lure Gentile Women." Jewish writers and anti-Semitism never mention that Jewish domination of the slave trade or prostitution existed over centuries. They never point out that such Jewish activities could understandably lead to unfavorable attitudes toward Jews. Imagine the worldwide media reaction if Gentiles were enslaving hundreds of thousands of Jewish girls, putting them on auction blocks, subjecting them to indescribable brutalities. Consider the outrage that would bellow from the Jewish media. Yet with millions of Christian girls becoming victims of Jewish criminals, There is no moral outcry, no international cause trumpeted by celebrities and politicians. After my discussion of these issues on the national PBS program Black Perspectives in the News, attacks on me as a, quote, anti-Semite became even more shrill. As a young man, when I read about slavery in the South, my heart was touched by the tales of cruelty and suffering, so much so that I felt guilty. But as I learned the truth about the slave trade, I noticed that the same Jewish writers and producers and publishers who instill guilt in me about slavery and the slave trade never once suggested that Jews had any collective guilt for 2,000 years of plying their trade in human flesh. Apparently, in the new morality of the Jewish press, learning about white exploitation of blacks is history, but learning about Jewish exploitation of both whites and blacks is called, quote, hate, unquote. The next section is called disloyalty. Historically, the most common term other than moneylender associated with Jews has been tax collector. There have been many examples all the way through the 20th century of Jews being the main instruments of tax collection that ruling bodies used to raise revenue. The Jewish historian Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, tells the story of a Jewish tax collector named Joseph in the court of the Ptolemies, who was so ruthless and effective in collections that he bid twice the amount of anyone else for the right to collect taxes. In those times, kings often took bids from tax collectors, and the one who promised the highest set amount would obtain the commission, and he would keep for himself all he collected over the amount he promised to the king. Joseph's success came in no small part from the fact that he would kill and confiscate the property of those who refused to pay what he demanded. Josephus described his success as, quote, stripping Syria to the bone, unquote. Yet he showed no restraint in his praise. Quote, Joseph was a good man and of great magnanimity, and brought the Jews out of a state of poverty and meanness to one that was more splendid. That's, again, the quote from the Jewish historian Josephus. Rulers of multicultural empires often used Jews as administrators because the ruling powers knew that they would have no loyalty to the non-Jewish people of the lands where they resided. Jews made excellent tax collectors, they had good financial acumen, and they had the required trait of all good tax collectors, little sympathy for the taxpayer. In the Muslim world, the practice of using Jews as occupying administrators can be seen in the Arab conquest and rule over Spain in the 8th to 11th centuries. In the Fatimid rule over Tunisia in the 10th century, the Marinid occupation of Morocco in the 13th to 15th centuries, during Mongol rule in Iraq, and in the 16th century Ottoman period, the practice was continued even into the 20th century in Morocco, where the French used them in this role over Muslims. In the post-World War II satellite states, the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, and even at one time in the control exercised by King Faisal in Iraq. One of the most repeated charges that anti-Semites have made is that in retaining loyalty to their own perceived group interest, Jews have historically betrayed their host nations in times of war, occupation, and hardship. Byzantine history affords an example of a relentless conflict between the Jews and their host people during wartime. And this section is subtitled Constantinople, A Story of Repeated Betrayal. And I'm going to give you some of the quotes from historical sources of the repeated betrayal of the Christian people of Constantinople on behalf of the non-Christian invaders. Jewish writers Gedalia Alon and Michael Yavi Yonah show that Byzantine authorities prophetically feared that their Jews would aid Persian invaders. They were also correct in fearing that they would assist Muslim armies as well. Another, and you can get the quotations again and the documentation in my book and the exact sources where this comes from. And many of it comes from, by the way, Jewish histories. Jews were killed in great numbers after the uncovering of a Jewish plot to deliver the city to the Persians. Another one, Jews sided with the Persian invaders of the early 7th century in collusion with the Samaritans, massacred 100,000 Christians. Another, when the Christian Byzantines retook the city, Jews were forcibly converted to Christianity. Another, the Jews supported the Arabs when they conquered the area in 636-40. Another, in the 12th century, the Byzantine Jews supported the invading armies of Seljuk Turks. Another, in the 14th century, they supported the invasions of the Ottoman Turks, the final conquest of Constantinople occurring through a Jewish quarter with the active assistance of the Jews. And finally, in gratitude to their support, the Sultan imposed Jewish economic domination over his Christian subjects, and Jews immigrated into the area from throughout the diaspora. So here you see, ladies and gentlemen, is an example, and this is not in the book, but my commentary here, that where Jews in the same city, in the same empire, repeatedly, 1 century later, 2 centuries later, 3 centuries later, betrayed the people among whom they lived and worked every day, repeatedly. And many of these quotations that I'm giving you are from actual Jewish sources about it, talking about their own history.
Well, folks, that's the end of part 3 of chapter 8, The Origins of Antisemitism, Crime, and Treachery. And tomorrow we're going to be dealing with the subject of the Jewish role in the conquest of Spain and in Jewish disloyalty in terms of communism and other movements in more recent times. We also will delve into the story of Joseph, a traditional Bible story, but I will take quotations directly from Genesis and Exodus of the Old Testament and try to give you a different perspective on this story than maybe the one that we're all familiar with, but a very revealing story as well. And then we're going to go into the Jewish view of anti-Semitism. Again, thank you so much for your work and your support for this cause and these ideas. It's your dedication and your activism and your physical and financial support that enable my work to have impact and meaning. I cannot do this by myself. It takes many, many thousands of people all over the world to spread this data. And when I'm just speaking on this tape or at a meeting or lecture around the world, it will mean nothing unless the people listening take action to spread these ideas and to bring more people into contact with www.daviduke.com and let them also share the information, the vital information that is shared with you here. Thanks so much. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviduke.com.